Right, I think let's get going. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another Employment Law 101 session. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We work with employers that are all over the world but have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. As always, I'm delighted to be joined today by my colleague, Adrienne. Morning, Adrienne.
Morning.
I think it's fair to say we've both been a little bit under the weather the past week or so. I know you're still feeling it a little bit. So thank you for being available today to run through this session.
Not a problem. It's the lovely, lovely COVID is still out there.
Still rampant. Now, yeah, we'll save COVID implications for another day, maybe another topic. What we wanted to talk about today was just some of the new family law changes that are currently making their way through Parliament, with a focus on one in particular as well, particularly because the way that it's been reported, we think, is a little bit misrepresented. And if the new law comes into effect, then it will have an impact in terms of business planning. And we're certainly starting to feel the effects of a downturn now in terms of the sort of queries and projects that we're getting involved in terms of rationalizations and reorganizations and restructures as well.
Right-sizing, Peter. Right-sizing.
Right-sizing, as you put out in your article the other day. Yeah, redundancies or right-sizing, you choose the terminology. So we wanted to discuss those policies that are going through. Just a bit of housekeeping before we get into it. As always, these sessions are recorded. We host them on our website afterwards, and the audio goes on to Spotify. So if you want to catch up on any of our previous sessions, or you want to skip back and see some of the stuff we're talking about today, please look on our website next week. You'll find them all under the news tab. If you like to listen to our dulcet tones while you're out running, driving, walking the dog, whatever, go on to Spotify and catch our back catalogue of episodes as well. So please do that. The benefit of you joining today is that, of course, you can ask us questions in real time, and we'll do our best to answer them as we go along. If you do want to ask any questions, we're not going to open up mics at all, so we'll just read out your question. We won't identify you, but please use the Q&A tab, which is down at the bottom of the screen. Just helps us keep tabs on the questions that are coming in, but we love questions, so please think of something to ask us and we'll do our best to answer it. Right, Adrienne, do you want to kick off with the first thing that's happening at the moment?
Yeah, before we get into the nuts and bolts of the main piece that we want to talk about, we thought we'd just bring you up to speed with a few other changes. So the carers leave bill had its third reading in the House of Commons on the 3rd last week. And this is the bill that would entitle all carers to 1 week's unpaid leave to deal with caring responsibilities. So your normal employees, if they've got caring responsibilities. On the 6th of Feb, it had its first reading in the House of Lords. And so that's kind of making its way through Parliament. I think it was first introduced in about 2020, I think. But this is just a couple of things to note. This is a day one right, and there's the plan is that it can be used flexibly, so that 1 week's unpaid leave can be used in half days or whatever, but it's got to be used for long-term care needs. Now, when I had a look at it, the other thing to note is that it's not going to require any specific evidence to be submitted along with a request, and employees will be able to simply self-certify that they are they're a long-term carer. So that's chuntering its way through the legislative process.
Yeah, it's been a long while in the system, hasn't it? The second one that's going through at the moment is called the Neonatal Care Leave and Pay Bill. And what that bill intends to do is allow parents to take up to 12 weeks of paid leave each. And that's on top of other leave entitlements as well, like maternity and paternity leave. And the purpose of it is so they can spend more time with their baby if it's been born prematurely or it's unwell at birth and it's receiving that neonatal care in a hospital or other care setting. Now, this neonatal care leave, it will be available from the first day at work. So again, it's what we'll class as a day one right. But it only applies to parents of babies who are admitted to hospital during the first 28 days from birth and who have a continuous stay in hospital of 7 full days or more. So there's a bit of a barrier to get over in terms of eligibility, but I think that's a welcome piece of legislation, actually, because I know it can be incredibly difficult for parents of children who are unwell, and they need to take that time to be away from work and with the baby in the hospital. So that's going through the system at the moment. We're expecting that to go through without any problems.
Then we're coming on to flexible working. Now, this has already been all over the news about people have been saying that they wanted to have flexible working in law as a default or as of right. And the government has committed to introducing some further legislation allowing the right to make a flexible working request from the first day of employment rather than what we've got at the moment, which you need to have the qualifying service. So what they've said is they're going to take forward measures by means of primary legislation and then consider the role of guidance and awareness raising to achieve some outcomes, which they've said will include things like requiring employers to consult with employees to explore available options before rejecting a flexible working request. I mean, to be fair, that's the type of advice that we give to our clients already. Don't just look at their request and say, no, you can't do that. You've got to be entering into a conversation in order to see if there's a way of making it work and finding a compromise. So that's going to hopefully enter into law rather than just best practice. At the moment, there's a restriction on making flexible working requests to once in any 12-month period. The proposal is that would go to two requests, and then requiring employers to respond to requests within 2 months rather than 3 months at the moment. And interestingly, removing the requirement for employees to sort of justify how they think their flexible working request might work in terms of impact on work, impact on other employees, etc. So the government's already committed to supporting the private members bill that's currently going through Parliament, which would contain provisions to this effect. And alongside that, they would be looking at developing guidance on temporary requests for flexible working, so not a permanent change, and launching a call for evidence on how informal flexible working actually works in practice. And obviously, that's something that's come up massively in the new hybrid way of working, whether that's deemed to be flexible working or whatever it may be. It's a lot of words and a lot of proposals, but no clear time frame has been given for any of these steps. So that's where we're up to on that.
Yeah, we all hold our breath and wait for these changes to trickle through. I mean, in my experience, I don't know if it's the same for you, Adrienne, but I think a lot of the clients we talk to about flexible working, they take quite a flexible approach to flexible working of itself, you know, certainly around things like number of requests within a 12-month period. And I mean, my view on it always is, if you've got an employee who's really pushing hard for something, if you're just saying, look, sorry, the rules say you can only make one request, you've still got an unresolved employee relations issue with that person. They're still not going to feel particularly engaged or loved or well looked after. So it's in everybody's interest to at least talk to them about it and try and come up with a solution. Even if you don't come up with a solution, I think having the conversation and just trying to close down, you know, the actual issue is going to be helpful rather than just hiding behind the regulations. But of course, not all of our clients are as enlightened. Not all businesses are as enlightened as our clients. When it comes to that, right. The main change that we wanted to talk about today for the next sort of 15-20 minutes. Is the one that's been talked about the most in the media recently, and that's the Protection from Redundancy, Pregnancy and Family Leave Bill, to give it its full title. And that's a private members bill that's been sponsored through Parliament at the moment. What this bill would do is amend the Employment Rights Act 1996 to enable the Secretary of State to make regulations which provide for protection against redundancy during or after maternity leave. And it's the after part that's most significant. And it's protection against redundancy, not only for maternity leave, but also adoption leave or shared parental leave as well. And it's to add new provisions which allow for regulations about redundancy during or after a protected period of pregnancy. Now, the detail will obviously come in any subsequent regulations that are made, because bear in mind, what this bill does is simply give the power to the government, the Secretary of State acting for the government, to actually then later on bring in regulations. So we don't know for sure yet what those regulations will actually be. And I think, you know, over time, there have been cases where the Secretary of State has been given powers to do something under a bill and then never actually exercises those powers. Now, I'm sure that's not going to be the case here. We will see some regulations, but we don't know what the exact detail of those regulations is going to be. And there are some uncertain points. If we look back, though, to what the government have been telling us about these regulations, though, and what their intentions are, I mean, way back in July 2019, there was a response to a big consultation on these sorts of changes. And at that point, the government committed to extending redundancy protection to apply from the date that an employee notifies the employer of her pregnancy until 6 months after the end of leave. So if you've got an employee who's taking the full amount of maternity leave, so 52 weeks, obviously another 6 months added on to that is going to give somebody 18 months of a protected period. So a longer period of protection, basically. Now, this is what the government was saying in July 2019. With the government, July 2019 is a long, long time ago. There have been a lot of changes since then. And so, you know, we wait to see what specific regulations actually come through.
Yeah, so I mean, it's as you say, the devil is going to be in the detail here, and there are so many things that various groups, pressure groups and other lobbying bodies are aiming for. And some of these things were covered during the debate on the 3rd of February when the bill had its third reading. And Kevin Hollenrake, who's the MP and Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for Department of Business, what's it called? BEIS, keeps changing its name, so it's confusing. But did say that the government was considering the calls for various other protections. For example, limitation periods for claims to tribunals to be extended to 6 months, because some of the pressure groups are basically saying that, you know, at the time when women are vulnerable, or I should say those on shared parental leave, those on adoption leave are vulnerable and are very busy taking care of a new baby, they've got that 3 month limitation period to bring a claim to a tribunal if they want to complain about it. Now, sometimes that is A, just not possible. It's a very, very short window for most employment claims, and people have been campaigning for that to be extended to 6 months. He did say that he was going to listen to it, they consider it, but he did also note that the tribunal obviously has some discretion to extend the 3 month limitation period. Now, what are the circumstances in which that 6 months might already be in place through this discretion? Well, it's things like, you know, I was too unwell to bring a claim within the time limit, or there are COVID exceptions. So, you know, it's a little bit unclear as to whether or not that's actually workable for a lot of women on maternity leave in particular.
I thought his comments there, Jen, were a little bit tight, a bit mealy-mouthed. I mean,
I thought so.
You know, if you're in tribunal arguing that your claim should be let in out of time because you've missed a three-month time limit, you're already facing an uphill battle. Like the
Hurdle. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. We shouldn't let you in. You've got to justify why you couldn't get it in time. And bearing, yeah, like you say, bearing in mind the context for how someone's going to be feeling, you know, within 3 months of potentially having been discriminated against, it's completely understandable why 12 weeks, 13 weeks is not really a sufficient period of time to get your stuff together.
No. I mean, some would say 6 months isn't even, you know, enough time to be able to get yourself together and to have to face putting together an argument to prove to a judge why it's not been possible for you to bring your claim within the time limit does seem a little harsh. Mm. But I'm sure that those who are campaigning in that field can probably express it a lot better than we can with evidence and all of that kind of stuff. So another thing that they looked about when they were talking in the debate was whether or not there would be some kind of minimum threshold so that only those who've taken 6 weeks of the qualifying leave or more will qualify for the extended protection. I guess this is trying to balance the needs of a business versus the rights of the people who are going to be impacted. But it'll be really interesting to see how, on the one hand, they're saying we want to extend all this protection and make it really important, but they're still going to bring in these little restrictions and eligibility criteria. criteria by another means. But I mean, what Mr. Hollenreich said again is that the government will work with the Pregnancy and Maternity Discrimination Advisory Board, another natty title, to update its guidance, and is consulting also on the other side of the fence with all the various federations of businesses and unions to raise awareness of the changes. So, you know, it's an enabling piece of legislation again. So it's what Peter was saying. It gives the Secretary of State to make the powers, and there's no timeline. In the debate, they were very clear. We can't give you any timeline for when the draft regulations, which will actually put the meat on the bones of this, will be published.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is a bit rubbishy.
Well, I mean, people, you can look at it two ways. You can either say, look, this is a step forward. At least we're heading in the right direction. But it's just a question then of the various pressure groups ensuring they hold the government's task to make sure that this is driven through and that it's done right. Mm-hmm. But
Yeah.
What are the differences? Let's look at the differences. Mm. What's the current law?
Yeah, I mean, the current law is this, let me tell you. If a redundancy situation arises during maternity leave and it's not practicable by reason of redundancy to carry on employing that person under their existing employment contract, then that employee is entitled to be offered any suitable alternative vacancy, crucial words, where one is available. And that's got to start immediately after the old contract ends. Now, there is a bit of a blind spot, a little bit of an elephant trap that some unwitting employers have fallen into. And I've definitely had discussions with clients on this point over the years. The obligation is to actively offer the suitable alternative role. What you can't do is say what we're sometimes tempted to say, which is, hey, look, we've got these vacancies over here and you're on maternity leave. So, you know, we'll guarantee you an interview. You know, you're guaranteed to get through so far of this process, put your hat into the ring. That's not the right thing to do. It's not legally compliant. It's an obligation to actually offer the suitable alternative vacancy to the person on maternity leave, you know, i.e. would you like this job?
So it's proactivity from the employer.
Proactivity,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's how you tick the box. And bearing in mind that this includes a vacancy with an associated employer as well, something I think we were talking about in the office yesterday. But it's wider than just your small part of the business potentially as well. So bear that in mind. Now, when you step back and look at it, what's the lawful protection there? Well, it's basically a mechanism giving maternity leavers priority over other employees who are not on maternity leave, who are also at risk of redundancy though. And so it's what we class as positive discrimination. And if the employer doesn't comply with the requirement and messes it up, then they're liable for an automatic unfair dismissal. So that kind of extra layer of protection there. Now, before, I've got a practical example that I'll give just to illustrate how it works in practice. But I know we're just going to talk a little bit how this has all been reported in terms of the changes, you know, the bill that we just mentioned, and how it's been reported in the press, and how maybe not some legal commentators, but even the MP sponsoring it is talking in terms of what a change this bill is going to be. And I just want to give you an example. So the headline in The Guardian from 6 days ago, and I posted this, I'm pretty sure I posted this on LinkedIn. So if you follow me on LinkedIn, then you see my updates on this. And if you don't follow me on LinkedIn, then please by all means do follow us on LinkedIn. But The Guardian reported this private members bill as, this is a quote, if the bill goes through the Lords, firms cannot make women redundant from the moment the pregnancy is disclosed until the child is 18 months, right? And then it went on to say, currently women are protected from redundancy only while on maternity or parental leave. Now, that's not accurate. I mean, as I've just explained, there is additional layer of protection in terms of the right to be offered suitable alternative employment. But if there's no suitable alternative employment to offer, then there isn't any extra layer of protection. It's not a ban on making pregnant women redundant. Of course, you know, unless you are specifically selecting somebody because of the pregnancy, I hasten to add. But Dan Jarvis, who's the MP that's sponsoring this private member's bill, he's saying this is going to give a significant amount of additional protection and security. And I don't think that's really true either.
No, I mean, I know that some of the groups, including Maternity Action, for example, have said that the bill simply doesn't go far enough. You know, it's great that there is this extended period of protection, and I use the word protection in the loosest way. But what the original calls had been was for a legal ban on making pregnant women or a new mother redundant entirely, except in very limited circumstances, such as where the workplace was closing or part of the workplace was closing. That's, as Peter says, that's not what this is doing, or certainly not the position at the moment, and that's not what this is doing either, is it?
No, and I mean, you know, for all we know, once the Secretary of State has the power to change the regulations, they may suddenly go off on one and actually fundamentally change something. You know, that's the devil in the detail point we're talking about. But that would be out of kilter with the messaging that the government's been talking about, you know, and what the sponsoring MPs have been talking about as well. So realistically, it's very unlikely to happen. But just to give you a kind of a practical illustration, I've just lifted this directly from the Equalities and Human Rights Commission website. So this is, you could take it as kind of a good example endorsed by that statutory body. If you've got a company that decides to combine its head office and regional teams and create a centre of excellence, it draws up the new organisational structure, and that involves a reduction in headcount. Okay. Now, the company is intending that all employees should have the opportunity to apply for posts in this newly created structure. And if you're unsuccessful at interview, then unfortunately you get made redundant. At the time that this is all being implemented, one of the existing team members is on ordinary maternity leave. Now, as such, she has a priority right to be offered a suitable available vacancy in the new organisation without having to go through a competitive interview process. And that's the key thing. You know, that's where we've seen businesses saying, look, we'll guarantee you an interview, we'll guarantee you a final stage interview. That's not compliant. You've got to proactively offer the role. You take them out of the competitive interview process. What we're talking about here in terms of this new private members bill is extending that period over which you have to take into account women who you then will be obliged to positively offer suitable vacancies too. Mm. I mean, should we just talk a little bit about the business planning side of it, maybe, Adrienne?
Yeah, because I think one of the difficulties is going to be that, you know, for example, when we're speaking to clients, we often say, don't forget those on long-term sickness, don't forget those on maternity leave, because they'll obviously also have the right to be consulted. So in terms of your business planning, it will also be saying, right, do we know of anybody who's pregnant within the organisation that we might have to factor in, and how are we going to deal with that? And I think one of the key things that often comes up is, you know, what actually is a suitable alternative vacancy? And, you know, that's very often a tricky issue, and overlaps with a whole load of other things. And Peter, when I was listening to your example there, where you were talking about creating a centre of excellence, you know, you potentially got geographical limitations coming into that, because a suitable alternative vacancy is looking at the work that's going to be done is both suitable and, it says, appropriate for her to do in all the circumstances. So you've got things like skill set, pay levels, grading, hierarchy, you know, position in the hierarchy, and also the capacity and place in which she was to be employed, and any other terms and conditions of her employment. So, you know, how does this overlap with flexible working or hybrid working if you are, for example, saying, well, we don't think that is a suitable alternative vacancy because she's currently working in London and our new position is going to be in Manchester. So there's going to be all these types of little nuances that come into the discussion as to what's a suitable alternative. But fundamentally, your first point is to identify whether there is a suitable alternative vacancy, and then to offer it to the person who is pregnant / on maternity leave.
Yeah, absolutely. And that point about drawing the pool from who you need to be thinking of is going to be stretched out, because I've had discussions before where clients know that somebody's coming back from maternity leave, and it just so happens that, you know, within a month or two perhaps of maternity leave returning, there's going to be some kind of restructure, and it's just helping figure out, well, are they still in a protective period or not? What's our obligation about actually being required to offer this suitable alternative vacancy? Well, currently, once the maternity leave ends, that's it. I mean, even when, I think I'm right in saying this, maternity leave ends, somebody's taking a block of annual leave, perhaps, that they've accrued during maternity leave, you know, really common scenario. So perhaps they're using that leave for another month before they're then physically present back in the workplace. That's not a protected period. I mean, technically, maternity leave is finished. They've returned to work, but they're on annual leave. There's no protection. What you've got to watch out for once this bill is passed and the regulations come in is that you're looking then for anybody who has returned from maternity leave within the past 6 months of an exercise starting. So that just opens up that pool of people who potentially have this scope of protection being that little bit larger.
Yeah.
One of the tricky questions we get asked as well is, well, what do we do in a scenario where we've got more employees on maternity leave than we have suitable alternative vacancies? So, you know, let's say we've identified a suitable alternative vacancy, but we've only got one, and we've got two or three people who are off on maternity leave. That's really difficult. I mean, I'm not going to pretend I've got a silver bullet answer, because there's no hard and fast guidance on it, and we're not aware of any cases that have specifically looked at this point. But in terms of how we would advocate approaching it, first of all, make it an assessment of what you know about the employee in terms of their work experience and personal circumstance when you're answering that question of suitability, because it's possible that the alternative role could be suitable in respect of only one of the people who are on maternity leave. Now, that's not especially likely, but it's not impossible either. So really focus in on this point, you know, that Adrian was talking about in terms of what constitutes suitable alternative vacancy. Assuming that it is suitable for more than one person and you've still got this dilemma, you might look for volunteers for redundancy. So you might look to see if anybody sticks their hands up. If that doesn't resolve things, you're probably going to have to go through some form of selection process. So you're then into the realms of selection criteria, fair scoring. Obviously, the normal consultation requirements are going to apply to that. So they're not overridden in any way. So think about your general principles of fairness, and also think about the need to avoid any discrimination in terms of those criteria and how you're applying them as well. As I say, we're not aware of any legal authorities that have looked at this, but that just seems like the most pragmatic way of cutting through that situation.
I mean, there's other things that you can think about. I do think it's kind of ironic that you're looking at prioritising those who get priority. I mean, it's a really difficult situation to be in. But, you know, discussions about what, you know, there may not be a suitable alternative vacancy, but that doesn't stop you from having discussions around other alternative vacancies that may not be absolutely on point for being suitable. But, you know, in that situation, that's the typical type of conversation you'd be expected to have with people who are at risk of redundancy anyway. So don't forget to factor that into your approach, because it may well be that you speak to an employee and you say, right, there's three of you all got priority for this one job. We have, you know, we've got to figure out how to make it work. But also there are these other vacancies that are available if they're of interest to you, because we're happy to give you priority over those if we can make that work. And, you know, there may be people who say, well, I, you know, want to come back to a more junior job, for example, and I'd be happy to go into that role. Then that's going to be fine, because suitable alternative is very dependent on the individual circumstances of that person. So it's always worthwhile remembering that part of an approach as well.
Yeah, dialogue works wonders. I mean, talk to your employees.
Who knew?
Well, you know, who knew? It's easily overlooked, I think, sometimes. I mean, tying this back, though, what we think about these changes is the protection from redundancy pregnancy bill is disappointingly weak. And at most, it only stretches out quite flimsy protections. When you set these proposed changes against the backdrop of an inadequate tribunal system, it really doesn't change the landscape for workplace discrimination. There's still no legal ban on making pregnant women or new mothers redundant. And that's important. And, you know, I know Maria Miller MP, she's twice tried to introduce that sort of level of protection, I think in 2019 and in 2020. But both times it's failed. It's not gone anywhere because of a lack of governmental support. So I think when you scratch behind the headlines on this private members bill that will come into force, really it is shifting things very slightly. You definitely have to be aware of it in terms of business change processes and your planning for those. But fundamentally, it doesn't really change very much in terms of your actual legal obligations and the practical impact. You've just got to consider a slightly wider audience, I think. Okay.
Agreed.
On that bombshell, we're finished for today. So thank you so much for joining us, as always. Like I said at the start, you can tune into our previous webinars. We've got our back catalogue on our website. If you prefer to listen to the audio only, which is perfectly understandable, please check out our Spotify channel. You just need to search for Employment Law 101. We're going to be back in 2 weeks' time, same day, Thursday, same time, 11 a.m. Please spread the word if you've enjoyed this session. Totally open to feedback. And otherwise, enjoy the rest of your week. And we hope to see you all in a couple of weeks' time. Goodbye.
See you soon.